And welcome to minute 92 of Movie Around Minute. This is actually the penultimate episode. So hopefully you're listening to this today. This is a Saturday. We don't normally have shows on a Saturday, but because we wanted to finish up season two over the weekend, so today we have an episode, and tomorrow we will have the final episode so that on Monday we can start season three. So hopefully you'll stick around for that too. So this is the Daily Podcast, where we take a wild trip through the 1987 John Hughes comedy Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today for this special Saturday edition episode is Brian Lockhart of the Marvel Events Timeline Podcast and a whole bunch of other stuff. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me. And, you know, sometimes I can be known for being a bit of a chatty Cathy. So if I start, you know, if you catch me just blabbermouthing too much, just give me a shot in the chops.
Yeah, we talked about that a long time ago with what the chops were. You know, the chops are actually the jowls. You know, I always thought it was like a jab in the gut.
Same,
but
same.
After doing a little bit of research, it actually is. He's basically saying punch me in the face. So, which he did get punched in the face, but that didn't happen on screen. And we only get to see the black eye afterwards. You did notice that, right?
I did notice the black eye. And for some reason, I'm like, did I just like drift off and not pay attention to, because I rewatched the movie before we started recording, and I was like, did I miss something? Cause I wasn't giving it my full attention every step of the way. Cause I was doing stuff as I was watching it, but I wanted to refresh my memory. And I will say that it reminded me of Tommy Boy. A lot of this Tommy Boy borrows a lot from this movie, and they get in a fight in that. And they have the whole scene about like, oh, it doesn't hurt here. It hurts here, you know, but right here. And then I'm like, did I miss a part where he got hit? You know, cause I did notice.
Yeah, that was in one of the deleted scenes. So, you know, they had a right after they got their car towed by the policeman. So they were actually arrested in the original script, and Del somehow gets Neil strip searched along the way. And when Neil comes out, Del basically laughs at him and he punches him in the eye. You know, gives him a nice big shiner. They cut that. So it wasn't needed for the movie, but it's just funny that most people don't notice the fact that for the last, I guess, 10 minutes of the movie, so Del has a black eye.
Yeah. Like I said, I totally noticed it. It made me think of Tommy Boy every time.
Could be. I've seen Tommy Boy once. I'm not the biggest fan. I think I saw it like a year and a half ago, something like that. It was funny. I actually like Brian Dennehy more than any of the other characters in the or any of the other actors in the movie. So it was fun seeing Brian Denny until, you know,
yeah, he's not,
until he was no longer there.
Right. I say he's not in it much, but he's great for the bits he's in. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No question about that. All right. So minute 92 begins with the second half of the credit of Layla Robbins, because yesterday we talked about the fact that the minute ended with her credit actually being cut in half. We only get to see half of it before the minute ends. And so today we continue with that, and it goes all the way till the symbol of the Hughes production company. That'll be the end of this minute. So yesterday and the day before, we were talking about all these different crazy credits that we have here. So today we are continuing with the cast. You know, yesterday we basically only had 2.5 cast credits. We had Steve Martin, John Candy, and half of Layla Robbins's name. So then we continue, and so I just want to point out a few of the funny names that characters are given here. Like, for instance, Kevin Bacon is known as the Taxi Racer.
Yeah. Which I was surprised to see him in this movie. I totally forgot that he had a role in this at all, you know, when I saw him in New York. And I knew it was going to be just a small bit part, but I just thought it was funny to see Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. I mean, we discussed this actually, I think, on one of the first episodes, but in the original trailer, he didn't appear. But when they did I think it was the 20th anniversary trailer. So he actually was very predominantly in there, which is just funny because, you know, they're just trying to get people to watch it, you know, and you want to see this movie featuring Kevin Bacon, and you get him for, I think he's in 2 of the minutes of this entire movie. And And so it was also within the first week.
Right.
So he doesn't have that much to do here. And then the credits continue. We get the parents and grandparents, or sorry, we get the two sides of grandparents are listed here. The kids are listed. You know, it's just still make, it's just really funny for me that these people are listed so high on the credits, because there really isn't that much. There aren't any real characters besides the two main ones that last throughout the entire movie. So, I mean, you have Michael McKean, who gets fourth billing, and he's on screen for also like a minute and a half. I did the math last week, or maybe it was 2 weeks. I think it was last week. Yeah. Earlier this week, I did the math about how many minutes both he and Layla Robbins, or how many seconds either of them is on screen. And it's unbelievable. I think she's maybe on for like 3 minutes and he's on for like a minute and a half or something like that, if I remember correctly with what I did earlier this week. And to get third and fourth billing that for that is just amazing.
Yeah, it is funny, but of course he was a recognizable face, you know, compared to maybe some of the other people in the film.
Yeah, that's true. No question about that. And, you know, it continues down with we get the motel clerk and Doobie, and then the waitress who appeared for like a minute and a half also. And then we get the car rental agent, which was Edie McClurg, who, you know, we talked about her iconic scene in detail just a few weeks ago. And then we get Motel Thief, which is Gary Riley, which, you know, one of the things that we discussed during the minutes when he was, or the seconds that he was on, he originally was the pizza boy.
Oh, okay.
And basically in the script, Dell didn't really want to give him a tip because he was using Neil's money. So what ended up happening is that basically most of his scene was cut and they just show him come in and steal the money. So in the original script, he stole the money because he didn't get a tip. Okay. It wasn't that he's just a thief. So they, you know, I like the fact that his character was completely changed because of the way they cut the script. You know, so instead of him being known as the pizza boy who came in and stole their money because he didn't get a tip, he's now known as the motel thief.
Right, right. They're just in a bad motel, and that's just what happens, and not somebody that felt slighted.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it continues with some of the other smaller characters throughout the movie. We don't have to go into each and every one of them. Doesn't really make much of a difference. As I said, most of these people have relatively short scenes here. You know, we have the credits for the earring customers, which we have 7 of them. I think, if I remember correctly, I checked a few of them. They don't have any other credits. These are, you know, they don't even have any real speaking credits here either. You know, they're just listening to Dell's or John Candy's ad libs of how he's trying to sell the various earrings or the shower curtains as earrings.
I wonder if they just were, you know, typical background people, or if they even just locals and they were just like, hey, you stand here. You're going to get featured.
I think that's what it was. I think it was like, okay, stand here. We're just going to have you, you know, just hand over money or hand over, you know, look as if you're interested in what's being said or something like that. And at this point, we get 2 really strange credits from my perspective. We have Neil's stunt double and Dell's stunt double. Now, I can understand Neil's stunt double because Neil does fall a few times. You know, he has the point where he, you know, rolled down the embankment with the snow, you know, where he almost gets hit by the truck. So, yeah, and then maybe when he gets punched by the taxi dispatcher, you know, maybe at those are points where he needs a stunt double. But when would you think Dell needs a stunt double?
The driving. I would think some of the driving scenes, maybe.
You think that's what it is? It's the idea of showing them from afar, you know, and they're the ones who are driving this. Okay, could be. Because right after that, we have a great credit for Doobie and Owen stunt double. So again, it's the same person who is the stunt double for both the cab driver and, you know, Doobie the cab driver, and Owen, who's the son of Gus, you know, who's taking them to Stubbsville.
Dylan.
So, okay, Dylan, right? Yeah. Dylan Baker. I think you're right. It might be that this is just the driver for the far shots, so that you can, you know, so that you see who, you know, they're not the ones who are really driving. Could be. And then we get the screaming driver and the screaming driver's wife. So those are the couple that are trying to explain to Neil and Dell that they are driving the wrong way, not that they're going to the wrong city, but that they're going in the wrong direction. They're going against traffic.
Totally.
That's probably a better way to. Right. And then after that, we have two stunt drivers. So, you know, it's in addition to the other stunt doubles and stuff like that. I have no idea why they would need more stunt drivers. Maybe just, you know, maybe when the car spins around or stuff like that, you know, because then you don't need to see someone who looks like Neil and Dell in the car. So it could be. And then we have utility stunts. They're two stuntmen that are listed there. Again, I, you know, trying to think throughout the movie where someone would need utility stunts. Again, I'm not really sure. Do you have any idea?
Honestly, no. I mean, because most of the stuff, I mean, there's probably stuff we're not even thinking of that for what safety reasons, one way or another, you know, maybe when they light the car on fire. Something like that, like dealing with fire or anything that could be hazardous. Maybe that's where the more utility type people kind of come in and just do whatever.
Could be. Yeah, that's possible. Right. I'm always amazed at the end of credits, because you have, you know, it's color by Technicolor and lenses and Panaflex, camera by Panavision. You know, they actually show, you know, they're actually giving credit to these things. Which, I mean, it's amazing to me that just about every movie does this. I mean, I don't think that their cameras are donated or anything like that. It's just they basically are telling people, this is what we used to make this movie. And, you know, we're grateful for that, for them to be able to give that to us. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder why that is, because like this used to, you know, stand out to me. Was like it used to say a lot of times, printed on Kodak film.
Right.
And exactly. And Kodak was, you know, based in my hometown. So I was like, that always stood out if I watched credits all the way through. But you would think, yeah, they bought the film. So why? But is it just some sort of union rule that they kind of came up with, that these certain things would be in the credits? Is it just an acknowledgement?
Yeah, it's probably what it is.
Or just like, you know, hey, we do a lot of business with this company. It's like, maybe, I wouldn't say it's free advertising exactly, but. You know, maybe it's like, hey,
well, it's free advertising, but how many people are going to stay?
Right, that's what I mean.
The credits. You know, this isn't a Marvel movie,
right?
You know, where you're going to get a credit. You know, where everyone stays until the end of the credits, just to get that last, you know, 10-second credit that they're, you know, the tease that they give at the end or anything like that.
Although Marvel didn't,
you know, but then
Marvel perfected it of getting people to stay, but lots of movies have done it in the past. And I know there's,
well, you had all the Zucker movies that used to do
it. I'll give them 10 more minutes.
Yeah. You have all the funny.
So, and
no, I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about just having, you know, they put in funny lines. Mel Brooks used to do it also, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, you put in funny credits.
Yeah. Like a silly name or a silly credit or, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right. I think in like one of the Hotshot movies, they had something that says, you know, Secret of the Crying Game. And then it like says the secret after that.
Some of my favorites is like what they did with Cannonball Run, where they show the bloopers over the credits. Like that'll get me to stay all day long. Or Jackie Chan used to do that too, I think.
There are a lot of movies that would do that. But the difference there is they're, you know, they make the font. They do a split screen in most of these.
Yeah.
You know, so you have one side that's showing all the various goofs, and the other side it still has the credits.
Yeah, and to tell you the truth, I'm not paying attention at all to the credits when they do that. You know, like because I'm paying attention.
Right.
Now you want me to pay attention to the credits, put something funny in there every couple lines, and I'll start reading to look for it. You know, so that is pretty ingenious, actually.
Yeah, for sure. But you have to know beforehand to do it. See, that's the thing with Marvel movies. You know, everyone says, "Oh, I gotta wait and stay." You know, you're sitting in the theater, and half the people are getting up and leaving, and And then the rest of the people are just staying there waiting for to see what is shown on the screen.
I mean, we're like 25 movies in now for like the MCU, and it baffles my
28.
Yeah, I was saying there's a lot, and it baffles me every time I see half the audience get up. I'm like, do you people not realize that at this point, you're going to get at least one, you know? But the people.
I mean, just the date when we're actually recording this, I just saw the new Doctor Strange movie a few hours ago today.
Ah.
And the same thing happened. You know, people, half the theater just got up and walked out. And I'm like saying, what the hell? 28 movies in, you don't know to wait and see the little teasers that are going to be happening here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
So, yeah, we're going to tell you. And then the credits continue, and it continues with along the same lines. You know, it says Dolby Stereo in selected theaters.
Yeah.
So they're not even saying that you will constantly have Dolby Stereo. It's only if you're in the right theater.
Oh, yeah.
At least back in 1987. You know, things have changed slightly since then.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, that time and slightly after this, I spent a lot of time at, like, the dirt theaters with my dad. We would go, you know, wait and see a second-run movie at the Dollar Theater, and they were old. They were theaters he used to go to as a kid, so they weren't probably updated with the latest technology. Let's just put it like that.
Right, probably.
Yeah.
Probably not that. Yeah, I remember where not far from where I grew up, there were a few dollar theaters, and we would go see stuff there all the time. You know, those were a lot of fun to you know, to rewatch movies and stuff like that. I know that in 83, when Return of the Jedi came out, I saw it, I think, like 17 times in the theater.
Oh, wow.
Over the course of I think 10 months, something like that. So a lot of those were at the dollar theater, you know, towards the end of the run. It was still playing, but it was great to be able to go see them in the theater.
Yeah.
You know, it's too bad they don't have very many of those these days.
No.
You know, where you can go catch, you know, second run films, you know, not long, you know, even if it's just a few months later.
Yeah.
So because some movies are better to see in the theater if you can.
Totally agree.
You know, I'm all for watching stuff at home also, but still certain things. I remember when Saving Private Ryan came out, so I saw it in the theater and I loved it. And then a few weeks later, one of my good friends called me up and says, you want to go see it? And I said, no, I already saw it. He says, you know, you should come with me and go see it again. He says, this is not a movie that you're probably going to ever be able to see in the theater again. And it's something that you should see in the theater again.
Mm.
And he was right.
Yeah.
I mean, I love watching it, you know, on a screen at home, but it's still not the same type of experience.
Oh, yeah. I totally understand.
Yeah. And then we get the symbol for the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. And, you know, it says that this is the 28,537th, I guess, film that was made, you know, that's the registration number, 28537, which I found to be really interesting. And then right next to that, on the same line, we get the... you know, the AFL-CIO. So, you know, that sort of needs to be there, I guess. So what do you know about the MPAA?
Well, I know that they're inconsistent with how they write stuff. It's the Comic Code Authority, the Comics Code Authority of movies. You know, obviously, I actually don't know which one came out first. I would have to think the MPAA came out first, and that comics kind of borrowed that idea from them. But
well, when did comics come out? I could tell you. I can tell you which one came out first.
I think the Comics Code happened in the 50s, mid 50s.
Okay, so the MPA, as it was known at the time, was founded in 1922.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
It was the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America. The MPPDA,
huh.
You know, it's changed names so many times over the years. And then it was the MPAA from 45 to 2019. And then since then, it's just the MPA. They dropped one of the A's in there.
Oh, it's still AA to me.
Yeah. Well, it's because, you know, we're, especially when you're watching Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, it's still going to be MPA.
Right.
And I mean, the funny thing is that, I mean, I was reading into the history of this, and basically the funniest thing is that the MPAA didn't want any type of censorship, and the public didn't want censorship, but you know, somehow the MPAA started, you know, making sure that that things fit with their morals. There was no national censorship, but some of the states had, you know, their own requirements. And it turned out that there were movies that were sent to, you know, back in the 20s that were sent to various locations where people in the town were editing the movies. And people, you know, in order to because of the on-screen portrayal of violence and sexuality. And a lot of people just were getting very upset at movies because they just didn't make sense because they were cutting things out. You know, when stuff gets cut out, you don't really know what's going on.
Right.
And then they found out that in 1929, there was more than 50% of American moviegoers were living in places that were cutting movies. So that's why, you know, originally a few years before, the head was Will H. Hayes. He was the first president. He used to be the postmaster general of the U.S. So in 1924, he instituted what's known as the formula, which was a guideline for filmmakers where they would request that studios would send them synopsis of the films and they would review them. But the problem was is that because there was no obligation to do so, most people just didn't send them in. You know, so it didn't really make a difference. It was suggested. And so in 27, they changed it and they created a code that was known as don'ts and be carefuls, right? Which they would say all the different things. I wasn't able to actually find a list of what is on that, of what you were not allowed to specifically show. But in general, these were also largely ignored by the studios. They just didn't really care. You know, but in going back to 1929, usually about 20% of Hollywood scripts were sent to them before production. And even when they were sent to them, people still didn't keep to their word and change things based on what this don'ts and be carefuls were saying. So in 1930, they introduced what's known as the production code, which is still known as the Hays Code, which they it consisted of moral guidelines. And unlike the don'ts and be carefuls, this was endorsed by studio executives because they wanted to, you know, make money. They wanted to get the approval to be able to send out these movies and not have them get cut up. So some of the rules were that the code would prohibit any inclusion of scenes of passion unless they were essential to the film's plot. You couldn't have pointed profanity in either word or action. You couldn't have any sex perversion, which I don't know how they referred to, you know, how they described what that meant at the time. You were not allowed to have justification or explicit coverage of adultery. You couldn't have sympathetic treatment of crime or criminals. And you couldn't have dancing with indecent moves. And you also were not allowed to show white slavery. So, I mean, these are interesting things that they specifically tried cutting out. I mean, that's one of the reasons that, you know, in most movies from the 30s and 40s, if someone committed a crime, they actually had to get caught. You couldn't have a movie where they didn't get caught.
Yeah, I recall that. I took a film class, and that was one of the things that they talked about was like all these film noir, like you had the criminal had to pay in some way at the end. You know, right. they couldn't get away. They either had to be killed, arrested, or just. They have to lose everything. It couldn't be a happy ending for the bad guy, basically,
right.
or a gray exactly. or immoral character, even if they were the main character.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, I mean, since then, you know, or as time went by, they started making, you know, Joseph Breen became in charge of the Production Code Administration, which was part of the MPPDA, and starting July 1st, 1934, all studios had to have approval of the PCA for the movie before it was released. And if they didn't, they would have to pay a fine of $25,000.
Oh, wow.
You know, they started making it mandatory. And this lasted for almost 20 years. So in 1956, the new head of the company, who was Eric Johnston, who was the four-time president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, he replaced Hayes. And he made a revision in the production code, and he allowed the treatment of some subjects which had previously been forbidden, including abortion and use of narcotics, so long as they were within the limits of good taste, which I find really funny. Right. Like, who's going to say what's considered, you know, good taste or not? And then they actually added new restrictions to the code at the time that they would outlaw the depiction of any blasphemy or mercy killings in film. Hmm. And that basically lasted for a little over a decade, which obviously we've seen movies that didn't conform to that during that time, because it was not something that everyone wanted to do. But in 1968, in 1966, they got a new president of the MPAA, and that was Jack Valenti, who was president for 38 years.
Oh, wow.
And he was the former aide to President Lyndon Johnson. And what he did was he decided to get rid of the production code entirely, and he would have a system of voluntary film ratings, because they decided that they wanted to limit censorship of Hollywood films. And at the same time, provide parents with information as to what is being depicted or shown in this particular movie. So as we know, there are how many ratings do they have? What do you know?
Well, I know they've added a few, but let me see if I know. G, PG, say G, PG, PG-13 now, R, NC-17, X, and then is X.
That's it. That's it.
Okay.
That's
so
it.
I was saying triple X is kind of its own thing.
No, but triple X and X are pretty much the same.
Okay.
From that perspective.
All right.
You know.
And I,
so
I
originally,
was under the impression that NC-17 replaced X.
It sort of did. I'll get into that in a second. So basically, they started off with four different ratings. You had G for general audiences, which basically says nothing that would offend parents for viewing by children. Then they had PG, parental guidance suggested, right? Parents urged to give parental guidance may contain some material parents might not like for their young children. And then they had R, contains some adult material. Parents are urged to learn more about the film before taking their young children with them. And then they had X. Okay, now the problem with movies that were rated X was that it would basically put a stain on the film, and people would think that it was closer to, you know, the triple X movies that you were talking about earlier. So, you know, for instance, you have been a Best Picture winner that was rated X. Do you know which Best Picture the winner that was?
Well, I know MASH was rated X at one point. I don't know if that won Best Picture, but
it wasn't.
Okay. Caligula. No, they didn't get Best Picture.
That did not win Best Picture.
Shut up. No, I'm just trying to think of all the ones you knew traditionally. It's got to be, what, Porky's then? No, I don't know what would have been X that won Best Picture.
Okay, it was Midnight Cowboy.
Oh,
from 1969.
On that, actually. Because that subject matter, you would think, would have garnered an X. If something like MASH got an X, you would think that Midnight Cowboy would.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, so this is the way that the ratings went from 1968 until 1984. In 1984, they decided to make a change, and they added in the PG-13, okay, which basically says that parents are urged to be cautious. Some material may be inappropriate for pre-teenagers. Okay, now I remember when they started with PG-13. Do you remember any of the movies that came out in 84 that were – some of the first PG-13 movies?
Well, I can't think of what was first PG-13, but I know two movies in particular that I remember being a big reason why people were like, this is PG, was Gremlins because of the violence, and Indiana Jones because some of the Temple of Doom, I should say, because of some of the graphic scenes that are pretty tame, actually, by today's standards. But particularly the dinner scene, I think, is what kind of grossed people out. And they were like, this is inappropriate.
Surprise.
Yeah. So I can't think of what was whenever you say it, I know I've heard it before, but I don't recall right. What would have been the first.
So I know that Red Dawn was one of the first.
Okay.
I remember when that came out, and it was
you know, I just rewatched that, and that is so tame. I mean, I guess the difference is there is a ton of violence, but today when they show violence, it's graphic violence, where back then it was just violence in general garnered the higher rating.
Yeah. I mean, I did a little bit of research about it, and I've seen that, you know, a little bit of discrepancies as to what was the very first PG-13 movie. So you do have Red Dawn. I also know that the Flamingo Kid was rated PG-13, which came out also in 84. I saw that part of it had to do with the fact that, as you mentioned, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, and that was only rated PG. And as you said, I also saw about Gremlins, that also caused the stir, you know, that they needed to. But, I mean, again, when you look at these movies, they're so tame compared to today's standards.
Yeah, so what I – exactly. And so what I saw to back you up is in this one article, it said that Red Dawn came out in August 1984, but Flamingo Kid was technically the first to receive the rating from the MPAA, but that wasn't released until December 1984. But it was released so there's it depends on what you want to count as the first, you know, who officially received it or who actually was released first. So,
right. That's true. Right. So that was the first change that they made. And then about 10 years later, they decided that they wanted to change things again. And they, instead of having X, they changed it to NC-17. That was in 1990. You know, in order to what's funny is that if they say that you know, things that people will think of a movie as being more appropriate if it's NC-17 as opposed to X, it's pretty funny because it's still the same thing. You know, it's not as if they would say, okay, you know, NC-17 is now a different level than X. If they say that it's replacing it,
right?
So, like, what's the difference? It just sounds better. Is that what it could be?
I think so, because you're like, all right, and R is if you're under 17, you can't go unaccompanied, but you can still go to an R movie with your parents.
Yes,
you know, or you know, my theater used to, my mom would literally walk up and go, I'm giving these two their blessing to go see this, but I'm not watching it. And then would walk out and they'd let us in.
Oh, wow. that's cool.
Yeah. But, NC-17, I guess technically would be like, it doesn't matter if your parents bring you or not, you know, you're not coming in. So, I mean, that's kind of how I view the difference. But to me, X always has that like dirty, you know,
right,
kind of porno, you know, feel to it, even though a lot of these aren't necessarily, you know, porno films per se, especially the ones that now NC-17, a lot of times, actually, when I think of NC-17, I think of less of sex and more of like graphic extreme violence.
Really? I would think the opposite. I would think it has more to do with the graphic sex.
I used to think that
as
too,
opposed to the graphic violence.
Yeah. But now it's like, I always go to like, oh, this one's so graphic. It's gotta be NC-17. I mean, it's truthfully, it's both, you know.
Right. That's true. I mean, I got to tell you, since I'm 48, I really don't even look at ratings of movies anymore. No. You know, it doesn't matter to me.
If it looks good, I watch
it. Exactly. It's not a question of, you know, is there going to be, is it going to be rated higher because it's got, you know, more sex or violence? You know, hopefully it's a good movie. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah,
I'm looking to try and find the good movies to watch.
The only thing that I do sometimes look at, I don't even really worry about ratings too much now, because as my kids are becoming that PG-13 age, you know, where that's totally fine. You know, the Marvel movies are PG-13 sometimes. You know, I don't think twice about taking them even when they were little, but I made the mistake.
But that's also because of violence or perceived violence and language.
Yeah.
You know, you rarely will have an MCU movie where you're worried about the level of sex.
Well, right. And you just, I mean, at that point, I know what I'm getting with these type of movies. So it's relatively safe. So I don't have to think about it. But, you know, we were showing the kids the other day, and I've brought this up in conversation throughout the years about, you know, PG of today is not PG of the 80s. And, you know,
no, for sure not.
You know, we showed the kids, of course, had seen Christmas Vacation. and that's a funny movie. And you know, it's got a little crass stuff here and there, but it's mostly tame. And then we did show him the original Vacation because it's actually not that bad. You know, a couple crass things here and there.
There's a shower scene.
I can't remember, but I made the mistake.
Apparently you didn't notice when you were watching.
I don't remember, but I will tell this. I made the
mistake. You went to the bathroom during those few seconds.
Well, I think it's like one of those things. All right, it's real quick. It's real brief. You know, you get past it, fast forward it, whatever. We weren't too worried about that. But I remember going, all right, we all love European Vacation too, because there's some funny stuff. And we're thinking about like Rusty and all this stuff. I totally forgot that Clark takes
Russ.
He takes his wife for a night out in the town into a French nightclub, and it's a cabaret review. It's about 3 minutes of just straight boobs and girls dancing, and you know, the joke is, you know, she's the only woman there. He's all into it, thinking this is something classy, and not seeing how uncomfortable she is. And then we totally forgot about that scene, and we're like, this is a PG movie, and it's just boobs for about 3 minutes. So, let's fast forward this. And, you know, so we joke about it. We're like, oh, again, that just proved my point. PG, PG in the 80s, you might see some boobs. PG, you probably won't even see boobs in a PG-13 movie. It'll be R.
Right.
Like nowadays, it would be R.
Correct.
You'll get an F bomb or two. You'll get maybe one F bomb in a PG-13.
I think they're allowed. Right? I think they're allowed one.
Yep. But nowadays, if there's a single bit of, you know, you might get a butt shot. But after that, any other nudity, it's straight to R now. So it's just funny. You have to kind of be aware of what you're showing, or else you're going to end up like my dumbass.
Yeah, right. So then afterwards, we get the typical lines on the screen. The persons and events in the motion picture are fictitious. Any similarity to actual persons or events is unintentional. This motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries. Unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution, which, again, most people don't pay any attention to that.
I always think, when I see stuff like that, I always think of the you ever see Amazon Women on the Moon?
Yeah, of course.
They start the episode, you know, the movie.
I'm on a podcast just like you, dealing with Amazon.
Oh, that's
hopefully,
right.
Yeah, hopefully that's it'll right. be out. Hopefully it'll be out by now.
Yeah, you know? It's right. Has it come out yet? Yeah, I forgot we were both a part of that. But the whole opening scene was they were pirates, and they stole a VHS tape. And
right.
And it says the FBI warning. They go, ooh, I'm so scared. And my dad and I would say that every time we saw that warning. Oh, I'm so scared.
Yeah.
So that at the end reminds me of that, you know, that they would add VHS tapes when you rent it. Yeah.
Definitely makes sense. And then this minute ends with the logo of the Hughes production company. Okay, it's basically, it looks like a flag turned on its side. It has a white stripe on both sides and then a star in the middle. And underneath it says Hughes. So it's basically an H. Then underneath it says Hughes. So this is a production company that was created by John Hughes himself in 1983. And it was initially based at Universal Pictures. And they had a three-year production agreement with them that they would do things there. And then in 1985, they moved to Paramount. And after that, they had deals with Warner Brothers and 20th Century Fox. That lasted till the early 90s. And basically, John Hughes made 18 different movies from this production company during that span. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting to see that. So you have anything else for this minute?
No. Well, no. I'm...
All right. Well, this is actually the perfect segue then, because even though it's Saturday and we normally do this on Wednesdays, but because Brian wasn't with us on Wednesday, we're going to do today Hughes Hump Day. So basically, Brian will give us his top five John Hughes movies. So start with number five and work your way up.
All right. I noticed that pretty much every single one that I've picked seem to be ones he wrote. I could be wrong. Maybe he did direct one of these, but number five is Weird Science. Okay. Number four, Mr. Mom. I actually just recently rewatched that with our kids, and that was a big hit. And I forget how funny that movie is. And of course, I'm going to round out the bottom three, or the top three, I guess I should say, with the National Lampoon's Vacation series, as I just mentioned. National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Well, you can't do a series. You got to pick one of them.
Oh, come on. I'm going to do all three. Number three is European Vacation.
Ah, okay.
Number two is The Original Vacation. And number one is Christmas Vacation, because that is a classic in my house. Every Christmas we watch that at least once.
Oh, wow.
And it doesn't get old.
No, definitely doesn't. That is very true. All right, great. Thank you for that. So every day we do a segment called Off the Beaten Track, where either myself or my guest will give a little story or adventure or misadventure or something that happened to us along the journey of life. So, Brian, you have another story for us?
I do. This one involves both a plane and an automobile. Unfortunately, I was trying to think of any way to include a train, and I just can't. I can't find one that had all three, and this one definitely does not have anything that would even remotely, you know, become part of a train. So we get two out of three, and that's not too bad.
I don't think anybody has able. I mean, this is the second to last episode. I don't think that in the 91 stories that we've had up until now, anyone has been able to get a story that has all three. So you're in good company.
Okay. It's a tough call, but I got two. So I cannot, this is where my memory is a little fuzzy. It was either pre 9/11 or post 9/11, but before they put a lot of the security restrictions in place. I actually feel like this was pre 9/11. My roommate was working for Midway Airline, an airline that is no longer in service, but it had direct flights to our hometown. So he took a job so that he could, you know, every couple of weeks just fly home for free, just, you know, because he moved down and we were buddies in high school. So he had this idea that he wanted to fly up. And that, you know, I will say it's pre 9/11 because we were able to cross the border to Canada freely at that time without very little restrictions, or like now you have to show a passport. At the time you did not. So we were sitting down, we both worked odd hours. It was like a random Wednesday. I was off for the next 2 days, he was off that day and didn't have to work till for 24 hours later that next evening. And he's like, what do we say? Like he wanted to go to Canada basically because there's a casino up there in Niagara Falls. And so
gambling.
He's like, right. And so he's like, caveat, we were under 21 at the time, but you could drink in Canada if you were over 18, but under 21. Right. So we basically had to figure out, okay, so how are we going to get up there? Well, he flies standby, no problem. And then he could get me a cheap flight for like $50 round trip. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I was like, great, let's do this. So the only caveat was both being under 25, we needed to make sure we could book a rental car. But we found a place that did it because of, you know, we had like a corporate card or something like that. So we're like, all right, great. Booked, everything set. So we fly up. We actually dress up. We're gonna fly up and we're gonna high roll tonight. We got some money burned in our pocket. We dress up, put our suits on and stuff. It's like Vegas, baby. We're like swingers, you know. So we we get on.
And, money,
right.
Money.
So I remember like we also like skipped security because he like had the key to get us in. Like we went through the main security, but then we didn't have to go to the gate. We actually went across the runway and got to our gate, like through these back doors where he worked. It was pretty cool. So we get into our plane. It's late at night. Now this is like 10 o'clock at night. So yeah, it's like an hour and a half flight or whatever. So we get there, we get our rental car. We actually fly to Buffalo, New York, get a rental car, drive up to Buffalo, New York. We're listening to Sweet Caroline. We're from Buffalo to Niagara Falls. We get across the border, you know, and then we just have a night of debauchery. You know, we're drinking, gambling, just having some fun. Well, we tried to get a hotel. All the hotels were super expensive. It was like 4 in the morning and we're going to leave the next day. We're like, we'll get a cheap, you know, discount on the hotel since it's the end of the night. But they were all booked up and stuff. So they were charging just a crazy amount of money. So we're like, forget that. So we are leaving we decide we're going to leave the casino, pull off to someplace in the car and just sleep for a couple hours and then drive back to get our plane. Because we're like, we'll just sleep on the plane. So we put – as we're walking out the casino, I throw a couple bucks in a slot machine. I win 200 bucks. So I'm like, great, breakfast is on me. So we leave, have breakfast, pull over, find a place to kind of nap. And it's like, all right, now by the airport. And then we turn around the car in. We get on the plane and we're heading home the next morning. Everything is just hunky-dory. And all of a sudden, I hear a pop. And I'm like, that's weird. And I'm already – because we're in the very front row of the plane. We hear a pop. I'm like, uh-oh. And I'm like, but don't worry about it. Just try to keep sleeping. All of a sudden, I'm like, I feel like we're going lower. I think we're landing.
Oh, wow.
I think we're landing. And I'm like, we haven't been in the air long enough to be even close to our destination. And then the pilot comes over. We've had a little, minor, everything's fine, but we've had a little, problem up here in the cockpit. We need to make an emergency landing in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we're like, okay. So we land in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we're like the first people at the gate because we're right there waiting to get off the plane. We're first in line. So I'm talking to the pilot. Turns out a bird hit the windshield and cracked the outer windshield.
Oh, wow.
And the inner windshield was fine. And he's like, we were fine, but we didn't want to take any chances. And so we landed. So I was, that's what the pilot was saying. We're like, man, that's crazy. What are the chances? So whatever. So we're like, all right, all these people are going to want to be on standby flights to get to their destinations. My buddy had to work later that day. I was free and clear. So we decide to, all right, we run to the counter and we start getting our tickets and they go, oh, you're employees. And I'm like, well, I'm not. And they're like, yeah, but you're flying on his employee discount. You guys are going to the back of the line. We can maybe get you one tomorrow.
Oh, like, wow.
Yeah, because everything was like delayed and all that. And there was this debate. And we're like, my buddy's like, oh, come on. I got to literally work for this company like later this day. And they're like, sorry, nothing we can do for you. So what the heck are we going to do? We ended up renting a car. And so we rented a car. And this is now after being up all night and, going to Canada on a whim, we decide that we're going to drive back. And I had to get him back in time to start a shift. So we had a limited amount of time. I think we had about 8 hours to go, what we should have taken us 6 hours to drive. And of course, we were both exhausted. So I ended up doing all but a half hour of the driving. I remember we just basically, cannonball run it, Smokey and the Bandit, our way down. In fact, at the time we were the most tired. All of a sudden, Eastbound and Down came on randomly on the radio.
That is great.
And we were just like, yeah, it just really energized us. And we just, we just cannonball run it all the way home. And, we made it back and had just enough time for a quick nap. And it was off to work he went. And of course, I crashed out for the next 24 hours pretty much after that. But that was my misadventures of, trying to go, on a last minute jaunt up to to Canada and then had to drive back instead.
Wow. Wow. Great story. Thank you very much for that. Mm-hmm. That was great. All right. You want to tell people once again how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah. I mean, the main show right now that I'm doing is Marvel Events Timeline Podcast, and that is on both Twitter and Instagram as Marvel Events Pod. And also you can find my other show, which is Hamilton Shot by Shot, that I'm doing, and that's Hamilton_SBS on Twitter. And my Movies by Minutes home is the Marine Corps Movie Minute podcast, which can be found on Instagram at Marine Corps Movie Minute Pod.
Excellent. Great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to this show. Finding me is quite simple. Just do a quick search. You can go to our website for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So thank you again, Brian. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And I want to remind everyone to come back again tomorrow on Sunday, which again is not usually a day that we have the show, but please come back on Sunday tomorrow in order to hear the final episode of season 2, and then come back again on Monday to start with season 3. So until tomorrow, you're fine.
You're fine.